Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, folks. You're all very welcome back to the Celtic Soul podcast. It's Friday and the weekend's upon us and the pubs are opening here in dear old Ireland on Monday. My guest on the show today will be singer-songwriter Declan McLaughlin from Derry's Bogside. And folks, don't forget, none of our content is behind a paywall or Patreon. So if you want to support us, you can do so by becoming a member, buying some of our merch, subscribing or donating for the price of a pint. And you can do all that by visiting CelticFanzine.com. And if you would like to sponsor us, and we'd like to thank all our sponsors who have come on board over the past year. Hard to believe it's a first episode of a new year because we started on the 29th of May 2020. So don't forget, if you want to sponsor us, you're a Celtic minded business or a Celtic supporters club or just a rich Celtic fan who thinks what we're doing is absolutely great, get in contact with us. You can get in contact with us through the website at CelticFanzine.com, by emailing us at info@CelticFanzine.com. And you can also contact us through social media, where you'll find us on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and the old-timer Facebook. Check out the website for all daily news and articles, and please download the app. It costs nothing, it's free, and you'll have access to everything we do, articles, podcasts, video content, info on events, and we do have info on an upcoming event, thank God. Delighted to announce that we'll be back on stage down in the Rue Glen Hotel as guests of the Port Largue CSC on November the 13th. So we're really looking forward to that. It's International Weekend, I believe, and I'll be joined on stage that night by the Hun scalper himself, Alan Thompson, and the holy goalie, John Fallon. And the entertainment looks great for that night. Fergus from Celtic Storm will be on stage, and so will Ian McLachlan. So really, really looking forward to that. There's still tickets available. I think the hotel is booked out, but there are other hotels in the area. I know tickets are going fast, so I will put all the information on that event in the podcast description. And there's also an advert on our homepage on the website if you want to check that out. It's been a mad, mad busy week. Issue 115 landed on the desk on Tuesday from the printers. So we've been busy getting that into envelopes, getting it out to everybody who bought a copy, and also out to our subscribers. And don't forget, folks, if you do subscribe, we'll throw in a free t-shirt. And thanks again to everyone for the support. On our t-shirts, we've got two new designs coming in the next 2 weeks. We've also got some new merch, and we've a lovely new bucket hat to keep the sun off your face in the summer. As I said, we're really busy with the fanzine, but the YouTube channel has kicked off really well this week. I was saying last week that it was a kind of slow grower, but not anymore. We've had a lot of interest in it this week. We put out a good few talks from the terraces. At a time, we thought we'd be taking it easy, having a quiet time after the season we just witnessed. But we had Matt McGlone from the Alternative View joining us. We had Eddie Toner, former Secretary of the Celtic Supporters Association, joining us to talk about the state of play at Celtic at the moment. And we'll also have David and Jeanette joining us from the Celtic Trust. That went out today. And we had Dan Orlowist, and I hope I pronounced that correctly, who writes for the Japan Times. And he brought us up to speed on the front runner for the manager's job at Celtic. Ange, as he's become known, because we can't pronounce the second name, but I'll give it a go. Ange Postecoglou, I think, is the one that everyone's talking about at the moment. Who knows? But if you want to kind of get an insight into Ange, well, then Dan's your man, and he'll bring it up to date on what he's won in Japan and where he brought the team from and where they are now and the style of football he plays. So it's very interesting. If you haven't listened to that, check it out. And everything we put on YouTube, don't worry, if you prefer to listen to your podcasts and audio, we'll stick them out on the podcast as well, which is available across all platforms. But please, if you're on the YouTube channel, because there's been thousands on it this week, just hit that subscribe button, please. Would really appreciate that. And also on the YouTube channel, we have a kind of a break away from the day-to-day, because it is a little depressing at the moment being a Celtic fan, but the Grand Old History podcast is out with David Potter, both on the YouTube channel and on the podcast. And we discuss Celtic cult heroes, and he's going to be back next week, and he's maybe going to do the history of the Celtic managers as we are speaking about them at the moment. And David will probably be the only thing we do next week, because we are going to take a little break. There'll be no show next Friday, and there'll be no show the following Friday, because I'm going on a little holiday. And Roland's 40, and I'm sure he's going to be out celebrating as well.
Yes, I am.
Folks, we have so many comments this week, and we've been so busy we hadn't even time to go through them or reply to them. So really sorry about that, but we will get back to the comments in the next episode. Look, so many folks, a lot of people that were working from home are starting to get back to work now and back into social contact with people. But over the past, I suppose, 14 or 15 months, I just want to thank everyone that has supported us. Richie, who's based in Scotland, our graphic designer. Thanks, Richie. Of course, Roland here in the studio. Daniel, who's been working from home on all our video content. Erin over in Scotland, who's been attending press conferences for us and doing some stuff on our Instagram account. And then, of course, every single contributor to the fanzine, all our writers and all the people who contribute to articles on the website. Can't thank yous enough, really, because it's been such a strange, strange time without seeing any of yous. I'm looking forward to really getting out and about from next week and seeing a few people. But I also want to give a shout out to the mill where we've been based. First class, what they've done for us. Because of COVID, they set us up in a separate room so that me and Ronan wouldn't have to see each other day in, day out. But we set up a little studio, and they've been great with equipment and helping us out. And the big news is that in October, we'll be moving into our own podcast studio here at the mill, purpose-built podcast studio, where we'll be able to get, I suppose, guests to come to us rather than us having to go to them. So we're really looking forward to that. And after, I suppose, a tough year or so, it's going to be great to get back and get people coming to see us here as well. So thank you very much. Well, Roland had only switched the power button off on the mixing desk when we got the phone call from Sharon at Celtic to tell us that Eddie Howe would not be the manager. So he has now become Eddie Who after 10 weeks of negotiations. As I said earlier there, Dan, the man of the Japan Times, well, he's been filling us in on Ange. And the latest news, as we say here recording, is Celtic are seeking a UEFA exemption for him to be, I suppose, allowed coach in Europe, because he doesn't have the badges, which is a load of bollocks, really, when you think of the experience he has, 25 years, and he has won a lot. And if you listen to the podcast with Dan, he'll fill you in. And I've contacted Celtic. I've said, look, can you let us know who's in charge of football matters as we prepare for pre-season, Champions League qualifiers and the league? Because I'm sure this is, even if Ange is going to be the manager, I'm sure this is going to take a long time. It's not going to happen overnight for UEFA to go through this. I'm sure there's paperwork and blah, blah, blah. So hopefully Peter Lawwell can give a nudge and a wink to his friends in UEFA and get this over the line, because it's we need stability at the club. But I've had nothing back from the club officially on who is in charge of football matters. Is it someone wearing a suit, or is it the tracksuits with John Kennedy, his assistants? Are they planning ahead? Because no Nick Hammond, no Neil Lennon like last year to plan. So, well, we know the plans didn't go too well during the year, but at least we had a plan in place. We have been invited to press conferences. We have been invited to the women's games. And we've also got an email to say that there's a new jersey which doesn't really interest me, but it will some people. But it's not really the kind of information we want coming out of the PR department at Celtic. We need confirmation of who is in charge at the moment of footballing matters. But it's not all doom and gloom. The Celtic women's team, if they win on Sunday, they'll be qualified for the Champions League for the first time. So well done, girls, and well done to Fran Alonso. And hopefully he'll get over the line on Sunday. And Erin Boyle will be at the game for us, and she'll do a little report and a few bits and pieces for social media for us. And she also attended the pre-match press conference, and here's how she got on.
Hi, Caitlin. Erin Boyle, more than 90 minutes. You're looking well in that jersey. It suits you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
A massive 3 points at Kay Park last weekend and on the brink of history. If you make it to the Champions League, what would that mean to you as a player, and how has it impacted the atmosphere at training?
Oh, it would mean the world. Like I said before, there's no bigger competition, and to have made it when people said we wouldn't is just a credit to ourselves and this team. But until then, we can't get excited or can't allow our emotions to be affected by the thought of that happening. So we just stay focused on Sunday.
How has it impacted the atmosphere at training? How are you feeling on the brink of history?
You know, we just keep the same momentum and the same philosophy and stick to what we've been doing every game, every training session, which is to just turn up, do our best for each other, for our coaching staff, for the badge. And we just keep the same momentum and the same habitual routines. And then we don't look up. We keep our eyes down, keep our heads down, and just focus on what we can do. And like I said, if Sunday, whatever happens Sunday, we'll be happy and proud of each other.
Thanks very much and good luck for the weekend. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
Hi, Fran. Erin Boyle, More Than 90 Minutes. How are you doing?
Hi, Erin. I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm very well. Thank you very much. Just one from me. A stunning double-figure scoreline at Kay Park last weekend. How does coming off such a big win like that prepare you and fire the girls up for the next fixture? And in this case, one game away from that historical Champions League spot, it must give you a real boost.
Yeah, it was at the beginning of the game. To be fair, it was similar that I'm telling you now. I was telling the girls. We told 3 points. We need the 3 points. We failed to take 3 points against them last time we played them here. If we think about Champions League, about league or whatever, our focus is not gonna be where we want it to be. So we focus on be aggressive and try to be. Obviously, I think we were clinical where we have to be. Although both of their goalkeepers, they have a great performance, but you know, obviously when we went to halftime 5-0, then is the first time when we say at halftime I said to the girls, look, there is a difference of 4 goals against Glasgow City. You know, what do you want to do? And then obviously everyone saw, you know, let's try to. And then we put the scenario where, you know, we were losing 4-0 and we have to try to win the game. And that's why when we score a goal, you know, you saw players taking the ball from the back of the net and sprinting to put it in the halfway line. And it wasn't anything to do with being disrespectful towards the opponent, not at all. It was to do with, you know, obviously we want to be in the best position to put pressure to the team that is ahead of us. And you know, obviously, I think as a Celtic player or as a Celtic member of staff, you always have to do your very best and you always have to be ambitious and try to, when you score a goal, try to score the next one. So, but yeah, after the game, delighted that the team that we failed to win last time we played there, we scored 10-0 when it mattered the most. Because that put us in a very good position this week, and also, you know, that add extra pressure to the other teams.
Absolutely. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure, and all the best for Sunday. We're all rooting you on.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Declan McLaughlin is a singer-songwriter from Derry, a resident of the Bogside. Declan has toured the world from Libya to Luton, and from his hometown of Derry throughout Ireland and all around the States when he was living over there for a good number of years and touring with his bands.
Hi Declan, you're very welcome to the Celtic Soul podcast. It's been a difficult year for those of us who work in the event, music and arts business, with COVID-19 shutting down gigs and events for over a year now. But with the vaccine now in play, are you optimistic about getting back gigging soon?
Yes. I hope, like, I think, like everybody, we want this thing to kind of pass, or we need to get past it, you know, physically, mentally, economically, socially, you know, just to kind of get some kind of, like, you know, social contact again back with people. I hope it's like the music industry or the entertainment industry, I think, has taken it pretty bad. But as far as writing and stuff like that goes, I have kept, you know, I have just kept writing, kept recording, kind of give me a bit of space where I didn't have to worry about going out there. See, I have a wee job, so I'm not, you know, I'm not feeding myself through my music. Thank God. Or I'd be a lot thinner.
You'd be hungry.
So I've tried to use the time constructively. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I walk in the events game and a DJ as well. And I, even when we get back, you know, okay, you might get a couple of gigs DJing, but if, like, for us to run an event, like, we have to plan it, we have to book it. The venue has to give us a guarantee. We have to pay the venue. Then we have to get our artist, be it for a spoken word or a musical gig or a festival or whatever we're doing. So, like, you're talking 12 months down the road, and that's the kind of scary thing. But I agree with you about what you're saying. You could write, and up until this, I was, you know, getting the fanzine out once a month, doing some live stuff, doing a bit of keeping the website going. But since the lockdown, I've nothing else to do, only the website. We started the podcast, we started a YouTube channel, and it's been very positive. And I have, like, it's positive for the mind, acting, because I think I would have struggled without having something to do, because we're not meant to be, you know, locked down. We're physical creatures. We're creatures who like to meet, and, you know, I love a pint, but I love the social aspect of the pub, you know.
Yes.
I never would have been really someone to sit at home and drink, and but on a Saturday night, I go to the office, exactly, and I get me a couple of cans, and I have a Facebook disco with myself. It's not something, I'm not into watching box sets, and it's just getting out. I'm missing the football shocking as well. So for you as a gigging musician, you've brought three albums out in this time, Declan, and in a short space of time, you think of it, three albums come out. But when I had Paul Heaton on the podcast, you know, Paul brought an album out, but he hasn't toured it yet. So you now have three albums to tour. How is that going to work?
I'm going to be busy. The reason why that came about was I had an album that I had recorded just three last year, which was The Path of Most Resistance. And I put that out when the fucking pandemic hit. So I was kind of sitting, and I had the time that I would have allocated for, you know, going out to tour and going out to push the record. And I would usually go to the States for maybe 2 months. All of that time, and then I had free. So what I started doing was looking at the stuff that I had recorded before that I had never ever put out, or I had only ever, you know, some of the stuff would be on demos and stuff like that. So I got some of it remastered, remixed, and I got a couple of pounds off the Arts Council here. So I decided I would put out those two albums. It's not like I recorded them last week. They were recorded over the last probably 5 years, but I had them sitting there and they were doing nothing. So I thought, right, here's, you know, I've been thinking about this for a while. So I thought I'll put them out, you know, and I'm quite happy with it. Like, they don't go, they have had them on sale here locally with a couple of shops in Derry just to give them a kind of chance. And then now this weekend, they're going to be out on, you'll be able to buy them on their web. And they'll be shipped all over the world, hopefully.
Yeah, we'll put a link on to the podcast description. So if you're listening, just click in and all the details will be there. Now, you mentioned that, you know, you were kept busy with the albums, and thank you very much for The Path of Most Resistance. We played a couple of songs on the podcast and they've been very, very well received. I hope we've introduced a few listeners to your music, and they're starting to say nice things about you. But Christy Moore and Damien Dempsey, you know, kind of tweeted and would be well known to all our listeners, and they've been very positive about your music. And you supported Damien in Vicar Street before the lockdown. So tell us a little about that release. You said you can't go out on the road to promote it, but you will be able to now. See the other two albums, right? Tell us a little bit about that. I still think that's the new album, but the two albums that you've just released, some of that stuff you're saying is 5 years ago. So
yes,
is it still relative now Or did, were you listening going, oh, like, how does that work?
Well, maybe I'll kind of give you a rundown. I don't know, maybe if people know something about the kind of musical background. My father was a musician. He played in the kind of show bands. He was in a band called Leroy Brown. And my mother was a singer. So I kind of grew up in a working class house where my father performing was the main source of income under the house. We were working class. So I kind of grew up, we surrounded with music. And then as a teenager, started playing in bands. And then maybe around me kind of lit things. Like after the hunger strikes, I started to realize that there was stuff going on around me that I, you know, like I was in my early teens then. And by about 1985, 1986, things here had deteriorated that bad that I was kind of surrounded with it. And what happened was my music, as I was kind of learning and playing music, I started writing about the stuff that was going on around me. So I became involved with a fella called Paddy Nash, and we started a band called the Screaming Bum Lads. Would have been the late 80s we started playing. But we just started writing about the stuff that was going on around us at the time. And although we kind of knew all the kind of rebel songs and all that kind of stuff, the kind of rebel songs that we knew, they didn't. It was Boys of the Old Brigade and it was the kind of the Wolf Tones and all that stuff. So we started writing, like I say, about fucking glue snuffing or the army raiding your house and stuff like that. And the reaction there was kind of positive because I think for a lot of other people growing up here in the town, we were singing about stuff that they could relate to as well, you know, about the dole and box clerks and like a song called Fine Day that people kind of say it's the unofficial anthem of the town, but it's about taking drugs and signing on. So then after the Screamo Bun Lads kind of by the 90s, you know, things had changed. Musically, we had done a lot better. The Screamo Bun Lads, you know, for people who understand or out of this community would understand the kind of reference to the Bun Lads, but outside of Derry and parts of Belfast, people wouldn't have got it. So we kind of changed the lineup a wee bit and changed. We didn't change the material. The material was still the same. We were still singing about what was going on. But we had a fella from Belfast called Tomás McShann joined us. He was a trumpet player. And we kind of formed the whole Tribe Sings. And we got a number of kind of offers of record deals and stuff like that in the States. And we decided to go over there because Guinness were using one of our songs in an ad. So we went over and spent the guts of maybe 4 years touring around America. And then I think because of the internet, because of like we were there when 9/11 happened, we kind of decided it was time to, you know, we were kind of tired at that point, you know. So we come back home and I just kind of kept on playing and recording stuff. And as I bought more equipment, like what I always done with the money that I was making out of the music, I always tried to reinvest it back by buying equipment and trying to get better equipment. And so what I've been doing is over the years, I've been buying wee bits and pieces of recording and I've kind of set up a wee studio in the house. And like I say, over the last 10 years, you know, with a lot of help from other people, I've been able to record these albums and put them out kind of cheap. And, you know, I'm not worried about a record label or anything like that. I just do it on my own time. And so that's how I've kind of got to this point. To answer your question, the two albums that I have just put out, one of them is called Breakneck Steps, which people from the waterside here in Derry, I know there's a set of steps. You know Derry, Derry's all hills, and there's a set of steps that run from Godmaskeel down to the end of the bridge, and that's what they were called, the Breakneck Steps. So I kind of, I spent a lot of my teenage years around that part of the town, so I kind of named the album after that. And then the other album is called No Big Deal, which was the first album I kind of recorded after the whole Tribe Sings and happened to be a lot rockier. People would know Rory O'Doherty from Kelly's Maine. He plays bass on it. And my sister's Tina sings on it. And there are a load of other local musicians. Happened to be a lot more rocky, where the Breakneck Steps one would be kind of soul dancey stuff. But the Path of Most Resistance and the High Flats album, they're fairly country because I think I've kind of come back round to listening to the music that, you know, when I was a teenager growing up, the stuff that my ma and dad would have been, you know, like Willie Nelson, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, all that kind of stuff. That's the stuff as a teenager that I was I mean, I was listening to Motorhead and the Sex Pistols and Black Sabbath. And I remember my dad trying to get me to listen to a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young album. Me going, fucking happy rubbish, I'm not listening to that. You know what? And I'm saying to me at the time, you don't get it, but you will. At some point, you'll realise how good this album was. So I've kind of come full circle to back playing kind of country happy music.
But that's what we all do, because, you know, I grew up, I was massive into ska. Like in my house, my oldest brother was a boot boy, so there was kind of glam rock music there, which, you know, Slade and stuff like that. The next Brandy Young was the next brother, was a punk who got into rockabilly. So I had everything from Stiff Little Fingers, The Undertones, you know, a local band to you, right up to the Stray Cats. And then the next brother came along and he was into Mod, so we had The Jam and I had Secret Affair and Dexter's Midnight Runners. I came along and it was Two Tone and Madness and that. But they all moved to London and my eldest brother got married. So I was left in a house with all these records, which I still have. So, you know, when I was getting bored playing my ska stuff and I was getting a little older and ska was kind of, the bands were moving on, you know, they were breaking up or they were moving to a different sound. So I was going backwards. And, you know, when you go backwards, I discovered Jamaican ska and reggae and everything. But it does go full circle, because my mother used to like Patsy Cline. I love listening to Patsy Cline. And I think when you get older, you leave your tribe as you get older and you become more aware of what your father says about Crosby, Stills and Nash. And you know, you start, like, my son's starting to produce dance music now. And a couple of years ago, if I even suggested a DJ to listen to, you know, like Tim Deluxe is a friend of Baz, my best mate, and Tim's, you know, a huge producer now and headline festivals around the world, and Fatboy Slim uses his, you know, his stuff, and he opened up his gig and that famous gig on Brighton Beach with one of Tim's tunes. Now, if I had to say to my son 2 years ago, oh, why don't you listen to Tim Deluxe, he would have laughed at me. But now he's wanting me to introduce him to Tim Deluxe, you know. And as you get older, you do, your music gets broader. And I wouldn't have listened to much, I suppose, rebel music or trad music when I was younger. I was probably late 20s when I really started to listen. Now, okay, I'd be at gigs and that, but probably, and I started maybe listening deeper. And that was probably the first band to get me into really listening to that kind of music, was the Blarney Pilgrims and the Glasgow Sound. It wasn't the Irish sound, because the Glasgow Sound was more punky. There was bass. There was drums,
yeah.
And that kind of, you know, and it kind of, it was like, it was trad music or Cayley music with balls, you know.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Because previous to that, like the best thing that I, you know, I'd ever come out of Irish music for me was the Pogues.
But yes.
Now I had bands like the Blarney Pilgrims and Shebeen and Aira Oak, and, you know, and I didn't have to go far. If I went to a Celtic game, I could go into a pub and see these bands. I didn't have to queue up or, you know, you could see them before a game or after a game, and that made a big difference. And I remember when they started to come, as you know, we spoke earlier off about them coming into Derry. I remember them coming into Dublin and that, and it was refreshing. But then, of course, what do? You actually go back to who wrote these songs, and then I was digging out old Barleycorn records belong to me, man. You know, so like it does go full circle. But I just want to stay on the part of No Resistance, because it did say there was, you know, a country feel to it. That's exactly what I got off, a country vibes, American feel. And did that come from your influences in America? You know, and did America change your songwriting?
No, I think growing up as a kid, you know, it was Starsky and Hutch. You know, America was the kind of, you know what I mean? I grew up in a place called New Buildings. It was a housing estate, a loyalist housing estate just outside of Derry. So you kind of get lost in a TV, and American TV was what we were getting at the time, you know, so always kind of, I probably romanticised about it, but I've always wanted to go. I've always wanted to see it. And I think because the music that I've always listened to has probably been 90% of it probably has been American music. But as well as that too, that kind of music is fairly easy to play. You know, you don't need to be fucking Wing Me Manstein or you don't have to be doing any of that there. And I love the fact that something can be stripped back. You know, what you're trying to, I always think what you're trying to do with a good song is you're trying to project an emotion as far as it can go, you know, that it touches other people, that you can write about something that is very local, but you can make it international, that you can make it universal, you know, because that's what I try to do. You know, a lot of them songs that I write would be very much, you know, American country. What I'm a lot of it is I'm trying to write about Derry. I'm trying to put some kind of connection to what I have here. You know?
Yeah, now when you say, you know, Derry, when you peel back the lyrics, they're kind of universal because every well has, I suppose, you sing about drink, you sing about drugs, you sing about what's going on around you, as you said earlier, but you can really see it in that album. And in the previous album, we played one of the songs, Freedom's Not a T-Shirt, which has become kind of, it was a favourite around the office here because Roland's a musician and I came in one day and I can hear him, when you sent him the MP3 and you put it on the end of the podcast, it was kind of playing along with him, you know. And like, we play out with a song every week, and generally he doesn't. Now he when we played out with Billy Bragg, he said, "Oh, I'm going to learn that as well," you know. But when I go onto YouTube to look at that, that song, and because it's on my Facebook Saturday Night Disco, which I share some Saturday nights, but. You do anything in the lockdown for company. But Declan, it's just, well, where does the description, it just says, you know, freedom's not a t-shirt. And you kind of say it's for people wearing Che Guevara t-shirts that are made in sweatshops. And it really got me thinking. And just tell us a little about that song, will you?
Well, the song kind of come out of, I don't know, people of a certain age might remember, this is a load of years ago. And they there was one of those fucking, you know, shabbily made factories, you know, and some kind of shanty town, and the fucking factory had collapsed, and there was hundreds of women fucking just killed, you know, because, you know, bad building regulation and no health and safety and all that. And I remember watching it and going, that was my mother 30 years ago, you know, working on the shirt factories here in Derry, you know, with the same, you know, that's, you know, for certain people, life doesn't move on. You know, we in the West, we live off the backs of these people in the poor countries, you know. And like I say, 30 years before, it was my ma that was in a sweatshop here in Derry, putting shirts together for Wranglers or for Lee or for those jeans factories and stuff like that. But and what they had done was that level of poverty had just moved to another country. And I thought to myself, here we are, we're wearing, you know, we want the best of fucking cheap clothes and we call ourselves revolutionaries. And, you know, so it's a wee bit about that than about it as about the kind of people that see protest. You know, there's more to politics than just protest. You know, there's, you know, fucking people dying at borders. There's, you know, just because you march around a town with a placard, you know, doesn't get you off the hook for what needs to be done. So it's just about accountability and politics and stuff like that, you know. So
you're obviously angry when you're
for this time of morning.
No, we won't put it out till 5 o'clock. So yeah, you're obviously angry at that time, and that takes me back to Derry, because when I think of Derry, we think of the famous wall, we think of Martin McGuinness, we think of the Undertones, we think of the Troubles, or the war, or the conflict, or what, you know, whatever people we think about, you know, Bloody Sunday. It's there's so much goes round your head when you think about Derry. And you were born there in 1969, and as I said, you know, a city at war.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in the sea, and, you know, when you first became aware that you weren't living in a normal society?
Right, well, to kind of give you again, my mother and my father was from Craigan, and my mother was from Ardmoor, which is just outside of the city, which, you know, then was the country. My ma didn't really want to move under, because when I was born, it was just exactly at the start of the Troubles. My dad used to joke, he used to call me a barbed wire baby, because all the kids that were born in 1969, that was a kind of term for us, barbed wire babies. And so we ended up moving out to a place. There was a number of these kind of, because of the housing issues, a number of kind of these, like housing projects were built out around the edges of Derry. There was New Buildings, Strathfoyle, Lettershan, Dunny. And what they were doing was they were trying to alleviate the housing problem in the city. So they were moving kind of Catholics out under these predominantly Protestant areas. They were mixing the house in the States, like, you know, 60% Protestant, 40% Catholic, just so that they could try and play with the numbers again. It was a form of gerrymandering. So we ended up living in new buildings, which was a huge, like, some of you may know of it. There was a large Protestant house in the States. But for a large part of it, it was cool, you know what I mean? Through the 70s and stuff, I didn't really understand, you know, I was just a kid. But I remember the whole thing about religion becoming more and more, you know, people saying, you know, other kids that are with you around, you know, talking about, you know, me being a Catholic and me trying to figure out what was the difference. But then as we got to the kind of the early 80s, the first hunger strike, then the second hunger strike, then, like, I was 13, 14. And at that age, you kind of realised, because the tension at that point had got the boiling point, because, like I say, we were living in a predominantly housing estate, a predominantly loyalist housing estate. So I would have been sent to Craigan, up to my Aunt Anne's, to stay when there was trouble. So it was safer in the heart of Craigan than it was in New Buildings. So just kind of, you see the army, the helicopter. Because I grew up surrounded with helicopters and soldiers stopping cars, it became so normal. And then by the time I got to secondary school, like, Paul Waters was a friend of mine. He was killed. My aunt was killed. I had a cousin, John Starrs, he was killed. So it was just kind of like normal stuff that you had the relatives in jail. So it was only when I became older that I realised how abnormal all of that was. But I suppose in the middle of it all, it kind of politicised you. And, you know, you were seeing it up close, that, you know, the army, the helicopters, the injustices that was going on. People were being killed on a regular basis. You know, people with inside of this community, we knew that the police and the paramilitaries were working together to kill people. But when he says that outside of this community, people looked at you like if you were, you know, a conspiracy theorist or something like that, you know, we knew it was going on. So that, growing up, kind of became involved in the movement in the kind of 90s, late 80s, 90s. Just selling newspapers, collecting PDF. And then the kind of Bloody Sunday Justice campaign began, and I kind of got tore under that. So I've kind of been part of the Republican community in Derry since I was a teenager. But like I said, then in 85, when we had to move out of New Buildings because the Anglo-Irish Agreement was signed and things got bad again. So I moved from New Buildings on the bog side, and I've been here since.
And did you move with your family?
Yes, we had to move out things, like I say. Like, at that point, I knew that there was stuff happening, but we kind of lived outside of the town. I didn't really understand what was going on. And then they started targeting, you know, the few Catholic families that were in that area. I went on all over the north. Catholic families were being attacked. And I'm not too sure if it happened the other way around, because I don't think the Catholic population was that cared that much about it. But we ended up having to move. The house was attacked a number of times. And I think at the time it was one of the biggest civilian population movements since the Second World War, because it happened right across the north.
And did it make you feel bitter?
No, not bitter. Because, like, growing up in New Buildings, our neighbours were Protestants, working class, and, you know, I seen they weren't sectarian. They didn't care. They treated me and my family just like anybody else. So for me to kind of move onto a town and say that I hated Protestants or something, I couldn't, you know. My neighbour, the woman who lived next door to us, was a woman called Mrs. Piper, and she was Church of Ireland, and, you know, she would give God a conscience. She was that good a woman, you know, so I couldn't put my hand on my heart and say that I dislike anybody because of their religion. You know, I'm not that fussed in any religion, but I'm not going to hate anybody because of their religion. But I seen it for, you know, like I say, at that stage when I became politicised, he kind of realised that this was, you know, that there was more to it than just Catholics and Protestants squabbling over the head of a piece of land, but it had to do with British involvement in Ireland and how long that had been going on. And, you know, the fact that we're at a point where we're arguing we're neighbours over the head of the Irish language or street signs, it shows you how twisted that they have left us, that we're fighting with one another when we should be looking at, you know, the health service or, you know, unifying the island, the education of our young people. That's the stuff that we should be out fucking marching about.
What would you say to those old neighbours and those the people from a different community or a different, I'm not going to say religion, but you know, a different branch of I suppose, the working class family, because at the end of the day, they need housing, they need jobs, they need education, the same as, you know, it, you know, you don't get it because of a certain religion. But when I look in from the outside, I see Catholics and the Northern Nationalists, you know, getting educated, you know, education, education, education. And when I hear people like Billy Hutchinson talking about the community he represents, it's, you know, he's saying, oh, they've been left behind and they haven't been. But it is, the key to it all is education. So, and now we have Edmund Poots, and I don't want this podcast to become a political podcast, but we now have Edmund Poots, who could put that community decades behind, not years, decades, as the, you know, as the face of unionism up there now. When, like, I'd be looking, if I was a youth up there and I couldn't get a job, or my family couldn't get housing, he would be the type of person I would be looking towards for leadership. But I don't see that. Whereas I do see the majority of people up there buying in to nationalist politicians. They may not agree with them. They may not have believed at the start of the Good Friday Agreement that this was the best case. But I think when you look, even if people look in from the outside now, you know, you're close to a ball of poll. United Ireland is on the cards, like an independent Scotland is. Now, what that Ireland looks like, you know, what does Declan McLaughlin, who's written about all this and sung about all this and sung about social issues, what does he say to these kids from different communities now?
Well, for one, it would be that we're in a position that we have never, ever been in before, where we can plan, we can sit down now and say, what do we want on the island of Ireland? You know, if you want to be British, you can be British. The same way that somebody living in Spain who's from Britain can say that they're British or say whatever they want. But we need to look at the island as a whole and how we build it in a way that it defends and supports everybody on the island. There's only 6 million people on this island. And if we can't resolve the fucking issues that we have now at the minute, there's something bad. There's somebody, there's other people pulling strings. You know, what I would say to the kind of to unionist working class people, you know, who are basically the same as myself, is this is a chance for us to set right all of the fucking shit that has happened in the past and give our wings and give the future a chance, you know, to be something that it's not. I think most people would be, you know, if they were told that the island was going to be there to look after them and that they had a stake in it, then I think, you know, most people would buy on that. I just hope that working class Protestants, like you say, I think they've been sold a pup. You know, for the majority of the kind of Catholic nationalist population, you know, that idea of a united Ireland is on the cards is now something that, you know, it's inside of our kind of mental framework. You know, it's not like, you know, if it's going to happen, it's when's it going to happen and how's it going to happen? And I think the unionist leadership they've been denying this. You know, they should be saying to working class Protestants, look, this is the best deal that we're ever going to get. This is, if we want to negotiate, we need to negotiate now, because in another 3 or 4 years' time, we are not going to be in a position to negotiate anything. We will be that small that we will just soldier on without them, you know. But I hope, like, I don't even think that'll happen. I think we need to look at new ways of kind of social governance. You know, I think that, you know, just taking what the Brits have already done and replicating it, I don't think it works. You know, I think to a certain extent, we have to non-colonize our social interactions, our politics. How that would happen, I think probably 4 provinces, we assemble government in Dublin. I think it's all there to negotiate.
You know, yeah, that's very interesting, because I kind of thought there would be two, there would be Parliament in the 9 counties maybe, and then Parliament in Dublin, until eventually they would merge, you know, there'd be transition period, like something like Hong Kong or something like that. Yes. But look, it's all, I suppose, to play for everybody. Now, in Derry, you are not a Celtic fan. You're not a Celtic match-going fan. But yeah, when Celtic fans came to Derry and when the bands come over and that,
yes,
that's when you became aware that, maybe you were aware before that, but was that when you became aware of that, you know, Celtic was much more than 11 men running around after a ball on a Saturday afternoon?
Well, it kind of to me, it would have started, like I say, I'd have been involved in the organising of the Easter March and the Bloody Sunday March and the stuff that would have been happening throughout the year. And there would have been always meetings where you were bulleting people. So, like I say, at some point, probably 70% of the Glasgow Celtic supporters have slept on my living room floor because we used to bullet people all the time from bands. And then I got to know Gary Oak and a lot of the musicians and stuff like that, you know. So, again, kind of growing up, Celtic wasn't really there was other stuff going on, you know, outside of football that we had to contend with. But it was only when the supporters started coming over from Scotland that I realised that these people are all Celtic supporters. And then, like I say, I realised then the history behind it and the solidarity for not just for us, you know, for South Africa, for the Palestinians, for, you know, Black Lives Matter. And I think it's that sense of community that has drawn me towards it. I know fucking nothing about football. I couldn't tell you whether the ball was stuffed or blew up. It's the people who are involved in it, and anywhere I go, that's what I look for Celtic supporters clubs and a lot of the gigs that I would play, even across the States, you know, at Celtic supporters clubs, because they'll have heard about me through other Celtic supporters. So it's part of a community that I feel part of, you know, even though I don't know nothing about football.
But it's interesting you should say the States. I find a great sense, and it's kind of like the GAA over there, the Celtic Supporters Network, which includes, you know, a lot of Scottish people who left the islands and a lot of Irish people. And then there's, you know, you've the token Yanks, like my big mate Rick, who lives in Detroit. You know, Rick was in the American Navy or the American Army, and he was based in Dunoon. And he went to see Celtic and he fell in love with them. So there's so many different stories. And like all his kids now, nothing to do with Ireland or Scotland, are Celtic fans, and they travel over the games, and which is a long journey from Detroit. But I find there's a whole sense of community, even between all the clubs. They help each other. Yes. They look out for each other. When you go to the convention in Las Vegas, and I know it's now just thousands of people, but you'll see the organisers of each club having their AGM and putting plans in place for getting games beamed in or fundraising or whatever you do. So I would imagine that, like, over there, that if you live in a town or a city that has a supporters club, you're kind of drawn to it because it's kind of an extension of your Irishness. Because as Hugo said last week on the podcast, you feel more Irish when you're actually living abroad than you do.
Yes, you're more conscious of it. As well as that too, it's because the whole Celtic thing is there's a left wing, you know, there's a political element to it that you don't get with the AOH, that you don't get with a lot of those other kind of Irish organisations. You know, people who are part of a Celtic supporters club in Boston are there, you know, because they're Republicans, because they believe something bigger than just the football thing. And I think that's a very important part of it. It does to me, anyway. Like I say, one of the first times I was in New York, somebody says, look, we're going to Iraq. There's a Celtic match on in Rocky Sullivan's, when Rocky's was up in Lexington, Lexington Avenue. And we went at like 7 o'clock in the morning. And like the whole of New York was, you know, people shuffling about going to work. And you opened the door and looked under Rocky's, and it was like looking under hell. I was just, I was like, close the door again and stop. I don't want it. And Rocky's used to be like that. And it was like, you know, hundreds of people jammed under a bar to watch a football match. And no aggro, no, you know, it was all just good humoured people, you know, that wanted to be with one another and support their team, and, you know, and all that meant, you know. So that always, like I say, has attracted me, because I kind of think, right, and it's also a very working class thing as well. You know, you kind of get for your muckers, your football team, your politics, get drunk and have a good time, you know. So, but Rockies used to be good in New York, now the Celtic supporters.
I've had some great stories about different bars. I have a brother that lives in upstate New York, and he often would go down to a bar, but the lad that he would have been down to is, I think he was deported, so he was illegal over there, so I don't think he goes down anymore, but he did, he would have told me a couple of good stories about, I think that was the Fenian boys, I think he used to go down. I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure. Now listen, we mentioned America, we mentioned Derry, but why we're in America, just take me back to gigging over there, because Johnny Vaughan tells me that you played in his pub one night, and he said a lot of the people that turned up, the Irish community, were expecting a re-rot or some rule of bullion. And in his words, he says, Like he walked in with the band, he says, and they blew the fucking doors off the place. That's a gig I would have liked to be at.
You want that's when the whole Tribe Sings wasn't. We were kind of full swing. We had kind of mixed Irish folk music, ska, reggae, punk, kind of guitar. You know, the garage band. We had merged all these type of musics together, and you know, although we were singing again about kind of fairly, you know, heavy issues, we done it in a way that people could dance. Because to me, it was always, you know, if you're playing music, you're there to entertain people, and you have to give people a wee, you know, you can't. I'm not fucking Van Morrison, you know, where you can just stand and just do it. To me, it's about, you have to interact with the audience. You have to fucking give them something. So I think we were very, very good at that. And what happened was, we couldn't get fucking arrested here. Like, we were jamming the bars in Derry and Belfast that we were playing in. We were ramming them out the doors. People kind of got on to the sound that we had. But we couldn't record labels. Nobody would touch us. We couldn't get fucking, like I say, we couldn't get arrested because of what we were and where we came from. So Guinness were looking for a song. They were launching Heart Lager in America, and they were looking for a song. And they heard, we had a song called Happy, and they wanted to use hits for the ad in the States. So we got paid a bit of money, and we thought, there's no fucking point in us being here. We had enough money to kind of get ourselves to America. So we went over there. We lived in Chapel Hill for a while, the kind of southern states. And then we moved to Bloomfield in Connecticut. And that was how I met Johnny Vaughan. Him and Desi were working in a bar called Half Door in Connecticut. And what people used to think was, because we were Irish, that they were going to get Diddley D stuff. And we were far from it. Not that we could play Diddley D stuff, and we used to drop it in and out of the songs and stuff. But we weren't a Diddley D band. We were a bar, ska, punk band, you know. So, but I used to get a really good reaction, because the kind of, I think the Irish community in America as well were looking for something, you know, that wasn't Diddley D, that wasn't, you know, that we had merged all these other forms of music and kind of come up with our own form, a kind of, like a really good bar band that people could dance to, that you could jump up and down to, that you could believe in. So we went down really well. But what happened was, we toured and toured. We were there for like 3 years touring, just up and down the A95. And we signed a record deal with a record label called Valley in New York. And then September 11th happened, and the atmosphere really changed, and the record industry began changing. And it was just at that point in time when the internet was taking over and record labels were closing. And so we kind of thought at that point, we were tired. We were doing a lot of drinking. We decided to kind of knock it in the head. So the kind of band broke up, and I stayed on for a while and then moved back to Derry again, but still kept performing and going back out. But this did, I loved it. Like, we played CBGB's a few times. We played the 930 Club in Washington. We played the Kennedy Center in Washington. We played all the kind of big venues up and down.
CBGB's, that must have been some buzz.
Oh, Jesus. That was, that of all the places that I have ever played, that was after we played in CBGB's, I thought to myself, I can give up now and fucking die happy, you know. And the thing about it was, we played there one night and we were on early in the bill. They used to have like 5-6 bands on, you know. So we were on really early. And the guy who owned the place, he's seen us playing. And he says, do you want to play tomorrow night? I'll give you a better slot. You can move. You know, I'll put you on second last. So we were doing nothing the next night. So he says, aye, okay. You know, so the next night we went down, and there was us. There was like a heavy metal band called, oh, they're really big now at the minute. But there was them. And they had to change around their slot because they were playing somewhere else. So they says, the us stuff, will you, can we swap? We'll go on second, just go on last. So he says, aye, no bother at all. So we had been Derry fellas. We helped them on with their gear and off their gear. And they were like, this is fucking incredible. They were going, no other bands ever, you know, none of the bands would ever help you around here. You know, just give us a hand. So they hung about and watched us. So that was good to get playing CBGBs. And the Kennedy Center was really good as well. So there's a whole pile of places that we played on.
When I think of that, CBGBs, I think of Blondie. And I think of the Ramones. And the Ramones. That's the two that kind of stick out. And just off track, did the Undertones ever play there?
I think they did. I think they went out and done a tour with a Clash in the States during the late 70s, and I think they played CBGBs.
Oh, that would have been that would have been a good night. The class.
I know John. I must ask John has he ever played it. But hey, talk about a dirty hole. Jesus Christ almighty, it looked like somebody had fucking broke in trying to destroy the place. But just to stand on that stage, you know, you know what I mean? Everybody has played it.
And like everywhere you go, there's always an iconic music venue, and sometimes they're closed. I used to go to a pub for Scarfest in London, call it Sir George Robey. Closed now. It's a hotel. They knocked it down and built a hotel, I think, which is a shame because that was a brilliant gig. But thankfully, Glasgow still has King Tut's and London still has the 100 Club. And I always make it my business when I go anywhere to go to these venues. And sometimes you go and the band is crap, like it's not what you're into. But if you can get a band that's half decent or a band you've never heard of, I remember going to see a band called Parker in King Tut's one night, and they were meant to be the next big thing, and it was sold out. Glasgow band, and a mate of mine was a music journalist at the time, and he said, "Yeah, I'll get us on the guest list." And we went along, and I bought the CD, and I was playing it when I was gigging. I was telling everyone about this band. 6 months later, I said to Michael, "Michael, what ever happened to that bag?" He says, "There was a row in the dressing room that night, and the lead singer left, and every record label was there to see them, as a lot do in King Tut's, and he flipped the lid that night, the lead singer. That was
the end, yeah.
But that happens in music.
Yep, yep.
And where are we? Ah, yeah. So the States, and then coming home to Derry, you're still playing music, you're doing a solo thing now, but a bit different than what you were doing. And then, as you said, you know, you're not relying on gigging to be paid because you have a day job. And you walk, am I right in saying that you walk with street drinkers?
Yes. I work in a place called the House in the Wales. It's what's classed as a harm reduction unit, but what it really is, a kind of residential unit for, you know, living quarters for street drinkers. So that's, we kind of become a long-term living facility for people with alcohol and sometimes drug issues, you know. But I've done that kind of work on and off. It's on the bog side, so I've always been kind of involved in community work, and that was always, you know, so that's what I do. It's a 25-bed unit. And what happens is the men are allowed to drink, and they're allowed to drink on the project. There's an area set aside for them. So it means that they're not out sitting on the street. They have an alcohol agreement in which they get so much alcohol per hour, you know, maybe a can of beer, a can of cider. So it means then they can kind of maintain their drinking. And it means, like, they're not getting, you know, hauled off to hospitals or arrested or, you know, like, I think Glasgow and Derry understand that we have an issue with alcohol, I think more so than any other drug. And if we don't start dealing with it in some kind of positive way, we're just going to continue to create more and more of it. That's what it is.
Yeah, there's one on the way. If you're walking up from the Gallagate in Glasgow, there's one. This is the Belgrove Hotel. It's an old hotel, and it's obviously... Yeah. But it's kind of like, you know... It's so sad, but it's funny because the lads are outside begging, and there's an off license right beside, you know, and it's like something out of Still Game, like, you know, and it's not funny, but you do smile when you see it, when you give one of them a couple of quid, and you know where he's going, you know.
I know there's characters involved in it, and us, but again, it's back to that issue of, you know, addiction is a serious, you know, mental health issue, and again, in kind of working class areas, it gets pushed out onto the streets, you know, and, you know, people are kind of ostracized because of it. And it's not, you know, we wouldn't treat people with cancer the same way. You know, people with addictions need to be helped. They need to be looked after. Sometimes they don't have the capabilities or the skills to look after themselves. And we do, as a society, do you have to kind of look after the weakest people that are there and the people who are sick and the people who need it. And I think it's important that we do. That's a reflection of the society in which we live in. And I think that's one of the reasons why I love Derry is because people in Derry are very, very supportive. Like, we would have virtually no people sleeping on the streets at night, or, you know, like, people are locked. We kind of look after our own, not look after our own, but we kind of look out for people, which is a good thing. You know, I think people here are very socially conscious.
Yeah, we have a dry homeless aid shelter, but you can't go in if you're drinking or on drugs.
Yeah.
But there's a local councillor, Joanna Bourne. She's been, you know, trying to get there's an old priest's house here. The chapel is closed, and there's a big huge house beside it. And she's been trying to get it turned into a wet hostel. Because there is people drinking on the streets, and we've had a couple of lads who've come in over recent years, maybe East European lads. I think they possibly could be from there. And one of them was a lovely man, and he was fed. A local shop used to feed him. Joe looked after him. But I walk my dog early every morning, and I would meet him most mornings because he'd be up early. I don't know. He was sleeping in a derelict house, and he would always stop and ask could he rub the dog. And his English was broken, nice guy. Obviously, had nowhere to wash properly. But he died there a couple of months ago, and we there was a fair play to the people in the town. There was a GoFundMe to get him, you know, repatriated, and a few quid for his family and that. But the lovely, this is a lovely thing. This man would, you know, people. He was a big, big, you know, strong guy, and people would probably be afraid of him if they seen him. But he was the most gentlest with me. I have a big dog, and he was so gentle with him. And wouldn't it be great if he would have had a place to go? Because I think Joe was the only one looking after him in the shop. He probably done a few things to Joe around the yard or whatever. But maybe he wouldn't be dead if he had somewhere to go. And as like you say, they're given a can an hour or whatever, it's controlled drinking. So they're not out in the streets in these cold nights or even warm nights. But, you know, if it's raining, they could be lying somewhere damp. So it's kind of sad. And I know there's resentment to it in my hometown because people don't understand. And maybe if they, you know, if they went up and had a look maybe at, you know, where the one in Derry, where there's no one sleeping on the streets, and maybe the likes of yourself could talk to them. Because I think, you know, it's education, isn't it? It's just making people aware that there is a better. It's great the way you spoke about the mental illness problems that goes with addiction. Because I think people just go and go, oh, he's a pisshead, or he's a scourge, or he's this, or he had a job, and now look at him, you know.
Nobody wants to be in that position where you're, you know, like I say, I work along with people with severe addictions, and it has destroyed their lives. And if you want people to get better, or if you don't want them to be a drain, you know, if, I know what you're saying is people have this kind of argument, oh, they're a drain in society, or look at them clogging up the city centre and things. I mean, the first thing that you need to do, if you want those people not to be in that position, is help them to get their dignity back. And the way that you do that is you treat them like human beings. You give them the same rights as everybody else. Now, they may fall down, they may continue to fall down, but some of them will get better. Some of them will address the issues that need addressed and will get help with their mental health issues. If we can't, as a people, you know, make sure that people have a roof over their head and, you know, the basics that should be afforded to every human being, you know, a roof over your head, somewhere to clean yourself, food and warmth, if we can't give that to everybody, there's something badly wrong. And see, anybody that denies that to another human being, you're fucked up. You know, if you can't see that there's issues that need addressing, you know, we can't just keep closing our eyes to it, because at some point it will come to your door. Like, see, for everybody that has an addiction, there is seven people, on average, there's seven people who are directly affected by it. You know, maybe friends, family, their work, but somebody else is being, and that has, you know, that impact upon society, especially somewhere where we have such a fucking issue with alcohol addiction, is massive. You know, can you imagine the amount of money, you know, like, what is 93% of the people in prisons are there because of crimes that were committed because of alcohol? You know, there's something badly wrong with society if we can't look after people and we just continue to criminalize people because of an addiction. It's something that it makes me angry, because I see it on a daily basis where people are being treated less than human, and it's so ugly to see, you know, a society where we're supposed to be civilized and people are treated so badly. Now, and I know we're a lot better at it here in Derry than a lot of other places, but it shouldn't go on anywhere. You know what I mean? There should be facilities for people who can't manage, people who find themselves, you know, like, all of us are only two or three paychecks away from the street, realistically. So we shouldn't, you know, we need to realize, or we need to figure out how we look after these issues and sort people out here and those kind of predicaments.
Well said, Declan. Well said. I know, but like, this podcast is about football, music, culture, social issues, yeah. politics. You know, there's no limits to this podcast.
Yes.
You know, like we'd all get very bored if we spent all our life talking about who scored that goal or who didn't score that goal. You know, so yeah, and it's you know, hopefully if someone's listening to this, it might change their opinion. If it changes one person, it's recording.
You know, a lot of my music comes out of that environment. You know what I mean? I'm saying, I sang about people getting out of prison or people going into prison. I sang about drugs. I sang about prostitution. The kind of stuff that I see around me. And I try to put a human fist to it so that it's not just somebody else. You know, this is somebody's mother. It's somebody's father. It's somebody's daughter who has been caught in a position. Like, you know, people who are involved in the sex industry, you can be fucking guaranteed that if they could have a job as a secretary, or they could be working in a supermarket, or they could be, you know, earning a good, they would be doing that. You know, it's because of the circumstances that they find themselves in, whether it be through addiction, whether it be, you know, mental health issues or homelessness. People are put in a position where they have to fucking do stuff that society, we push them further and further and further away from it instead of trying to help them.
Yeah, and when you think back to Shame Again song, The Pogues, The Old Man Drag.
Yes.
I mean, think about what Shane went through himself and the experience he went through. Should it queue up to shake Shane's hand now? But they wouldn't have when he was a teenager growing up in London, down in Soho.
Oh, they would have gladly sent him to the fucking gallows.
Yes.
Gladly sent him to the gallows. The same way that they would do. And this is one, you know, people spend that much time. We're looking down the ways at the people who are further down the ladder from us when we should be looking up the ways. You know, it's the people who are above us telling us that it's the people below us, that it's their fault. It's not their fucking fault. It's the people who we give the power to make the decisions that are supposed to, you know, these people are well paid. They take our tax. They fucking, you know, we love law and orderly lives so that these people are supposed to govern and run the state. And they're not doing it. They're fucking filling their pockets full of money. And the more power they get, the more irresponsible they become with that power.
Money corrupts. Money corrupts. Listen, Declan, before we finish up, I have a Celtic Soul time machine. Now,
yes,
a lot of people that have climbed in there have gone back to football games. A lot have gone back to gigs. Some have gone back to a few other bits and pieces. If I can take Declan back in my Celtic Soul machine to a moment in that musical career, will you take us back? But will you also take us back to a time in Derry that you realised that things were changing?
I can remember this probably maybe about 15 years ago, coming walking through the bog and hearing kids playing and talking to one another in Irish was a big thing for me, because the same kids, you know, fucking conversing on the medium of Irish was a big thing for me, because it was one of those, you know, we kind of promote the Irish language and we want our kids to learn it. But this was the first time. Now, I see it all the time now. But the first time I witnessed, I kind of thought, there's a sea change. You know, our kids are now talking the language of their fucking, their ancestors. Was one other things that I just think the change here has kind of been, not slow, but it has just kind of prodded along. I remember somebody who was involved with the South African stuff saying, you know, for the powerless, change doesn't happen fast enough. For the powerful, it happens too fast. And it's how you get that change to happen in a way that keeps everybody on side. Now, to me, I don't give two monkeys about the powerful, but I think there needs to be change to keep working class people. You know, we need to feel that we're moving forward. I sometimes wonder if that's the case when I see people's, you know, like how the working classes in Britain are voting for the Tory party. I just can't get my head around it at all. But if I could go back in time to something that, I don't know, I would probably try to look forward. I spend a lot of my time kind of thinking about what I'm doing next or where I'm going. I would rather think further down the line, probably to a point where, you know, we're negotiating what the new Ireland is going to be, that we're, you know, on the whole island of Ireland, you know, what's it going to mean for people in Cork? What's it going to mean for people in Coleraine? You know, and I think if the working classes here and then, in the six counties, who are fairly politicised, you know, if we could kind of negotiate something that, you know, that people can be Irish, that they can be British, that, you know, the island of Ireland has to move forward as one. So I kind of think that's where I would like to be. I want to be part of that discussion.
Right. And listen, just stay in that time machine, okay? Because I do want you to go back. I know you're looking forward. I want you to go back. Yeah. And you've got your guitar, or maybe you have your band with you. If you go back to one of them gigs that you played and one song that you played anywhere in Derry or America, or, you know, because we all have moments in our life where we go, wasn't that just magnificent? What would it be? Where would it be? Where would that gig be?
We've done the Millennium here in Derry, which to me was probably the best, not the best gig that we ever did, but the fact that we were headlining here in our home city for the Millennium was a high point for us. And then where else? We were a good time band. You know, people used to come to see us because we, you know, it was, you could dance, you could drink, we could, you know, and at that point in time when we were kind of on the crest of that wave, there was no, you know, it was that point between the kind of war and the ceasefires had come on, and the police weren't accepting pay, you know, so there was no law and order, so you know, bars could stay open, we could party, we could, you know, there was, as a community, we were looking after ourselves. So there was, at that point in time, I think Derry, you know, that's 94 up to 2002, probably was a great period, I think. There was a lot of creativity about then as well, you know. There was a lot of great bands in Derry.
Did Luke Kelly play in the Bogside during the siege of the Bogside?
No, they had the FLA here, and they had the Free Derry FLA in 1969, and Luke Kelly come up, the Clancy brothers come up, and there was a big festival here, which is, they have kept it going. They still have it every year. That's now the Gas Yard Wall Fela.
Sounds amazing. You know, in all the chaos, you know, to hear the late great Luke Kelly perform and the Clancy brothers in your hometown and in your home area, you know, for those lucky enough to be at that, it must have been so surreal, because what was going on around them.
Yes.
You know, well, Declan, it's been absolutely brilliant to get into your Celtic soul and to hear about Derry City that you obviously love, but we're looking forward to seeing you live. Hopefully you'll come to Drogheda and maybe Dublin. And the last time you were in Glasgow, I missed you played at the Thursday night and I didn't roll into the Friday morning.
Hopefully
we'll catch you, because I know Hilly and Bill Coyley and a few of the boys have been kind of bumming up your album, so and they're new fans, so I know they're looking forward to seeing you. And would there be any chance of getting this band back together? Because, you know, when we come out of COVID, we'd be looking for something. We lost a year of our lives.
One of the guys lives in America. We're scattered all over the place. And everybody's kind of doing their own thing. Now, there's chat. Well, we'll see what happens.
Never say never.
Never say never. If there's the right amounts of drugs and money, anything is possible.
So very rock and roll. Okay, Deg, I'm just going to finish with that. And listen, thanks a million. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
It's been so insightful just to get inside Derry, really. I think you've brought the listeners into Derry, and I think you might get a few more tourists now coming up after hearing.
Oh, please come. Honestly, God, because I've played all over the world. Like, my music has given me the chance to kind of go everywhere. Like, I've played in Libya, in France, North, South Africa, Australia, all over the States. And one of the things I have found is the people in Derry, the sense of community and their camaraderie and the way that they welcome people in. Like, I went down there, there's a wee bar here called the Celtic Bar, and you've probably been in it. And I went down there the other night for a pint, and there was a guy who wandered in from Belfast, just was looking for somewhere, and he went looking for the Bogside Inn, had mustered and ended up in the Celtic. I was leaving, it fucking must have been 12:15, and the wee guy was blitzed. He fell in with a pair of people who he hadn't a clue who they were, they didn't know who he was, but all of a sudden they were all the best of friends. And that's the type of people that love going here, you know, they look out for people, they want to welcome people on it. So come visit us.
You're an ambassador for the city. Thank you, Declan.
Thank you very much for having me. And sure, look, and I'll get you the tracks for the new album sent out now this week. Yeah,
brilliant. It was lovely to talk to Declan. I always wanted to get him on the podcast, and he's been a bit elusive, but it was great to get him on, because we've had no problem getting
some tracks for the podcast, and we've always had a great reaction to when he played us out of the show. So I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Very, very interesting. And a couple of names dropped there during as well. Damien Dempsey, Christy Moore, The Undertones, and the famous punk club, the CBGBs. Folks, I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but we do not put anything behind a paywall or a Patreon, so if you'd like to support us, please visit SalticFanzine.com, where you can become a member, subscribe, buy, or donate for the price of a pint. And if you donate this week, I will definitely enjoy the points, because I couldn't for the last year or so. Only joking, folks. Thank you so much for your support, and if you can keep supporting us, we'd really appreciate that, because, as I said, most of the content, with the exception of the fanzine, is free. Free for all to read, free for all to listen, and free for all to watch. Although, my mum always told me I have a face for radio. And as always, I have to thank the Bertie boy himself, 40 years old, Ronan McQuillan, for producing the show. And he also sang us out a few times during the year. And I tell you one thing, I'm looking forward to getting back in the pub and seeing Ronan doing a few gigs. And so I thanked everybody, I think, but just make sure. Daniel Faulkner, thank you so much for all the work this week on Celtic Fanzine TV. We put out quite a lot of content, and I know it was annoying you at different times in the day and night. So thank you. Okay, folks, just a quick recap. Download the app. Follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Follow us for the podcast, or hit the subscribe button depending on the platform you're on. And please hit that subscribe button on the YouTube channel. And if you're a business or Celtic Supporters Club and you would like to sponsor an episode of the podcast or become a sponsor across any of the platforms, please email us at info@celticfanzine.com. And as always, you can contact us through the website or message us on all those social media channels. So, folks, enjoy that weekend. I cannot wait. I hope the weather keeps up. I'm looking out the window here and it is sunshine all the way. I have a little session with Daniel, YouTube man, on Sunday. He's celebrating his lovely girlfriend's 40th birthday. And Ronan will be celebrating with his lovely wife for his 40th birthday. But on Monday, I think we'll all be meeting up, because guess what? You probably heard me over the last few months, but the pubs are back open. So Tip McCann, if you can do it in Uri, we can do it down here. So that's all I say, folks. Stay tuned, stay safe, keep the faith, and I am really, really looking forward to getting to see Declan McLaughlin in the flesh and sit down and enjoy one of his gigs. But in the meantime, shall we have to play out with Declan? See you in a couple of weeks.
Take me back, I think I'm going crazy. You stop me like a heart attack. You give me hope, you give me maybe. But I'm not the one who's dragging you down and destroying your name on the good side of town. It's no business of mine what you do with your time, when every second's like the last. I watch the sun awake the city. You know that I can't help myself. These morning streets, they show no pity. I go hunting your face in every crowd, and as evening draws near, my chances go slim. But it's no business of mine what you do with your time. You've been walking in shoes that someone bought you for dancing. The light on your face, it makes me feel like I'm falling, falling, falling.
It's always the same. You scream and you shout about the things that you love. You know nothing about, but it's no business of mine what you do with your time. You've been walking in shoes that someone bought you for dancing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.